Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show today, we talk about the book Mend or Move On, A Guide to Healing or Leaving Toxic Relationships. We hear the stories of work with prisoners on death row through the book The Deserving. Ryan Bush has created a film about Michigan's skiing legacy. We talk about that. Public, private, and nonprofit organizations come together to revive a tradition in Muskegon Heights for the MLK Day holiday. And DTE Energy and the Salvation Army Great Lakes Division are in partnership with other to help Michigan families stay safe and warm this winter.
Meet Kate King. Her work is important. The latest work, author of Mend or Move On, it's a guide to healing or leaving toxic relationships. Let's talk to you about the topic and more. Kate, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Welcome. Good. You are here. Many letters behind your name. Yes, a licensed professional counselor, board certified art therapist, nearly 20 years of experience. So art therapy, we know the importance as well, living in your beautiful Colorado. There we are. Let's get into your definition of a toxic relationship, Kate.
Yes, I actually define what toxic relationships are in the front side of my book because I feel like words are important. So if you'd like, I can just read you the definition that I wrote there.
Yep.
So my definition of a toxic relationship is a connection between individuals that promotes disease, unwellness, and or trauma due to harmful qualities to the mind, body, heart, and soul. Participants may be toxic in their behaviors, personalities, or qualities, or the dynamic itself may have become toxic, even if this doesn't indicate toxicity in personalities outside of the relationship.
According to your title, do we have a choice when we're in a toxic relationship? Do we have a choice to mend or a choice to move on?
Yes, this is exactly why I titled it this way, because so often when people are in toxic relationships, they feel stuck, and sometimes they feel like they don't have a choice to leave, and other times they feel like they don't have a choice to stay. So my entire book is actually about that tipping point and how to know if it can be repaired, if there's a possibility for healing, if there's hope, or if there's no hope at all and it will only cause further disease and dysfunction and you should leave. So that's actually the topic. And I think that's what makes this book unique, because most books talk about either staying or leaving, but they don't talk about that juncture when you're not sure what to do.
Thank you for that. What differentiates, Kate, a truly toxic relationship from one that, well, I guess I'll say merely misaligned or expired beyond its purpose, if we want to go there?
Yeah, that's an important distinction, because not every bad relationship is toxic. Sometimes they're just misaligned, they've expired, they've passed their season. So I always encourage people to look for three signs. The first is that the behavior that's harmful is consistent and persistent. It's not a one-time thing. It doesn't come and go. It's the real dynamic that is perpetuating in the relationship. And then secondly, the harm that happens from this relationship is real. You have to recover after you see this person. There's damage control that needs to be done. You have to go to your therapist afterwards. You're really feeling the trauma and the abuse from the relationship. It's not just irritating. And then lastly, there's a feeling in the body. It's like a push-pull feeling of wanting to be there, not wanting to be there, wanting to connect, wanting to disconnect. It's like a wrench in your gut and a lump in your throat, and your body's screaming at you that something doesn't feel right, something doesn't feel healthy, and the body doesn't know how to lie to us. Our mind knows how to be sort of manipulated and think abstractly and change, but the body doesn't. So if we listen to the symptoms of the body, we can hear a discernible no when it comes to these relationships.
Kate, your book, again, Mend or Move On, shares your 7 traps of toxic relationships. Give me a couple.
Mm-hmm. So the 7 traps are the ways that we get stuck, and people often find themselves in these sticky places. So the first is buy-in, which is buying into the narrative of the culture of the family or the relationship. Either, you know, we don't look at things, or this is just who we are, or abuse is part of our system. The second one is comfort. When people get so comfortable in the dynamic that they don't fight back against it, they become sort of complicit within it. The third is powerlessness, where people feel small and caged and sort of hopeless that it will ever change. And this can happen in control and power dynamics. The fourth is false ownership, which happens when people think that it's all their fault and it's all their responsibility to fix the problems in the relationship. And that's never the case in any relationship. But in really toxic relationships, often there's a scapegoat where the person is led to believe everything's their fault. Should I keep going?
Give me one more.
The fifth trap is unhealed trauma. Because when we're looking through the lens of our unhealed trauma, it's really difficult to relate in healthy ways. But if you're part of a toxic relationship, it's likely that you do have trauma to work through. And so if you can heal that trauma, you can escape some of those dynamics and the back and forth that's really unhealthy. But the unhealed trauma will keep you stuck.
Tell me about why constructing walls, physical, emotional, or energetic barriers, well, that keep people out, will that strengthen relationships?
It can, and often it can be necessary in toxic relationships. I define walls as sort of the strongest form of boundaries, where boundaries kind of communicate your edges. They let people know what you will do if your edges are crossed or if your limits are met. Walls simply protect you. They can keep you in, they can keep others out, and this can be really helpful if a relationship has progressed to a point where it's dangerous, it's unsafe on a physical or emotional level. But really living with relationships that have walls isn't a healthy relationship. So people who sustain that long time get burnout, they can get different kinds of health issues, and the relationship never improves with walls. So if people do choose the mend, the repair path, I teach them how to work with their counterpart so that they can ultimately put those walls down and replace them with healthy boundaries.
Kate, are there triggering words and phrases to avoid when working to repair a troubled relationship?
Yes, I actually have an entire chapter that's all about triggering words because it's important that we talk about words. I think that, you know, the words that we use, they live inside of each other. So one of the triggering words is the word but. I encourage people to swap that out for the word and instead. So, you know, they may say, I love you, but you're really hurting my feelings. And instead, I encourage them to say, I love you and you're really hurting my feelings, because it's more inclusive. It opens them up instead of shuts them down. So that's one example of a triggering word. I can share the other six from that chapter if you'd like.
Share two more if you would.
Sure. One of the words is actually the word triggered, because triggered has been banned from social media sites. It's a very triggering word in and of itself. And when people have arguments, if they use the word I'm triggered, that can be so triggering that it can shut down the conversation. Another one is the word bored. I'm bored in this relationship, because bored can often indicate that there's actually a deeper problem that they're not acknowledging, and they're feeling boredom in its place. And so that can be extremely triggering in conversations too.
Where does one start? Again, mend or move on, a guide to healing or leaving toxic relationships. Obviously, read your book, Kate King, but ask for, is there mediation? Get some art therapy going. What's the recommendation, in the health world?
I think if you have a truly toxic relationship, having professional help of some kind is really essential, especially if you're planning to repair. You probably can't do that on your own, because if you already had all of those skills to know how to do that, you would have done it already. So a professional can help you repair with someone, and also a professional can help you feel supported and resourced enough to walk away, because ending a really deep relationship with a spouse, with a longtime friend, with a family member, that is so deeply entwined inside of you that you have to make sure that you're strong and resourced and you have a strong sense of self. So doing your inner work is really important. And having supportive community and aligned relationships that you can lean on during this process is essential as well.
All right. Essential reading, if applicable, Mend or Move On, a guide to healing or leaving toxic relationships. Kate, how do we find out more information about your work?
Everything is on my website, theradiantlifeproject.com. You can find that. It's my hub. I'm also on social media. My handle is The Radiant Life Project.
Keep up your good work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Author Elizabeth Bartkessian on the line. Her work is out, The Deserving, What the Lives of the Condemned Reveal About American Justice. I look forward to this conversation with you. Elizabeth, we'll call you Liz as we move forward. You, a mitigation specialist, been investigating the life histories of those facing the most severe penalties possible in the United States since 2004. So credible. Thank you, Dr. V. Good morning.
Good morning. It's so wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. What keeps you up at night with this niche that you have?
You know, it's interesting. It might not be what people think. It has more to do with how I feel like our society is becoming increasingly distant from one another. And I know what that means in the long run. It becomes easier to hurt people who are viewed as different from yourself. And so that's the thing that keeps me up at night primarily.
You work with prisoners on death row as part of their defense team, interviewing them, you have, as well as their families and communities, to provide a broader context for their crimes. Are we interested in this topic? And you are finding what these lives of the condemned reveal. Is that the premise here with your work, The Deserving?
It is. I do think that people are interested in understanding how harm happens. And, you know, the work that I do is both with individuals who are facing the death penalty, but we also work in the organization that I run. We work with a lot of folks who are also facing life without parole sentences or sentences that effectively mean that they are sent to prison to die. You know, and again, I think so much of the interest comes down to the fact that as a society, people are becoming, I would say, more frustrated with the fact that, you know, significant trauma and harm happens within their community, and they're looking for ways to understand and address it. And the work that I've done paints a pretty clear roadmap of the ways in which, as a society, we're all implicated in how harm happens, and give some ideas on things that we could do to stop harm from happening in the future.
Before I ask for a couple of examples, obviously, what is a mitigation specialist and how does your work actually differ from that of a lawyer?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's not a very well-known field. So the law basically says that mitigation, the evidence that it considers to mitigate, is anything that's related to the background, character, or history of a person that's facing a criminal punishment. I actually think a much simpler way to understand it is to think that in the theater of the law, mitigation works to make sure that the humanity of a defendant is not lost. And if you think about what that means, it means that we have a criminal legal system that's essentially designed to dehumanize people who are accused of crime, and that's why my job exists.
Let's ask about your work. Each of your clients do bring their individual experiences to the table. All of them, I see, have been subject to dehumanizing systems. What approaches do you take to build trust and empathy here?
Time. And that can be a really difficult thing with the legal system that we have, because our legal system really is constructed to move people, victims and defendants, through as quickly as possible. And as anybody listening knows, the best way to develop a trusting relationship is to spend time with people. And so I spend many hundreds of hours with my clients, with their family members, people who have known them, members of their community. And it can take an awfully long stretch of interaction for people to understand that sharing the totality of their experience is the thing that's going to help in the legal process. And that just simply takes time.
Let's ask for an example of one of your clients, one of your stories, please.
Absolutely. There are a lot of clients that I talk about in the book. There's a client basically per chapter that I discuss, and the client that I'll talk about today, he features early on in the book, and I call him Connor. I use pseudonyms for the vast majority of the people that I talk about in the book. But what's interesting about Connor's case is that on the face of it, it didn't seem like Connor had a particularly difficult life. Most of my clients, in fact, most people who are facing severe penalties in the United States, are people who have come from a lot of disadvantage and dysfunction and have lived with a lack of opportunity and resources. But if you look at Connor, he came from a pretty, middle-class family. Both of his parents worked in education and in business. He lived in an environment where they weren't lacking for medical care. He wasn't going without food or shelter. And so on the face of it, it didn't really make a lot of sense why Connor found himself on death row. He had been convicted of killing an older man in his home. But when I got involved in the case, the thing that I discovered was that Connor had a history of abuse. He had been sexually abused by a family member for many years. And that once his legal team had discovered the abuse had happened, they stopped really asking questions about what it meant to his life. And so this idea of mitigation isn't just the fact that somebody has a traumatic experience, but it really lives in the space of how the experience etches away at the potential for this individual to flourish. And so really looking at what that experience meant to him, and what it meant to him was his family didn't really understand the fullness of how his behavior, he had changed in school. He had gone from being a pretty average student and, you know, being rule abiding to being a kid who really struggled with, you know, showing up to school on time. He started getting detention. He started using tobacco, which in his community was not really done. And his parents got really nervous and they didn't know what to do, but they didn't stop to ask questions. Nobody around him stopped to say, Connor, what's going on? Are you doing okay? And instead, they just made some assumptions that he must be using drugs or alcohol. And this was during the period of time under the Reagan administration when the Just Say No to Drugs movement was really in full force. And his parents shipped him off to a for-profit institution called Straight, Inc. And it's still operating under a different name at this time. And Straight was a place where family members who parents were very concerned about their children and their drug use were sometimes sent. And he was essentially tortured there for 3 years. And I'd say that experience was so profound to him. Between the ages of 15 and 18, he was stuck in a warehouse. He wasn't learning anything. He was abused by other staff members and peers his age. And by the time he was released from that institution at the age of 18, his trajectory had been completely changed. So I like sort of thinking about Connor's story as a good example that there is always this moment, no matter what it may look like from the outside for my clients, where something different could have happened and they wouldn't be my client. And I think that's very true in Connor's case.
Yes. I have a couple minutes for you to give an example perhaps of a female client.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I say this early on in the book, the vast majority of my clients have been men. I've only had actually now two female clients. And the first female client that I ever worked with was a young woman in Connecticut, actually, who had been sentenced to 80 years of incarceration when she was for a crime that she committed when she was 14 years old. That was the first case that I worked on that did not involve the death penalty, and it really stuck with me. She had lived a life of trauma and abandonment that most of my adult clients had lived over a more extended period of time. And by the time I met her, she was in her 30s. You know, she had grown up during the incarceration that she had experienced, and she was a totally different person. And, you know, it was this moment for me to understand fundamentally that every single human being changes. I am not the same person today as I was 10 years ago, and certainly I won't be the same person 10 years from now. And that is no different to any of our clients. And it became so clear to me that when we sentence people to prison for the rest of their lives, or what's effectively the rest of their lives, we somehow, you know, make this determination that they're just not the same people as we are. And that's just not true. I'll also tell your audience, the good news is that she has been out of prison now for the last several years, and she's doing great. And she's, you know, adding tremendously to her community. And that's something that I see so often with our clients who have come out of prison. They are eager to participate, eager to give back, eager to atone. And that is to a person the way that it is for all of our clients. So, she's the first female client that I've had, and it was a wonderful experience to get to work with her.
Thank you. Elizabeth Markesian, author of The Deserving, What the Lives of the Condemned Reveal About American Justice. What's your take-home message?
We could do better for each other, and we have to give people the opportunities to really to really grow. And we need to be thinking about the system of punishment that we have and what is its purpose. If its purpose is just to take a pound of flesh and to really be retributive and harmful, then we're doing a great job. If the purpose of punishment is to create a system where people can return to communities and be a part of those communities, then we need to be thinking about what is the role that we play in engineering a system that facilitates that.
Where do we find out more information about your work?
You can find out more about my book from my personal website, elizabethbartkessian.com, or you can also find out about the work of mitigation through the organization that I founded and run called Advancing Real Change. You can look us up at advancingchange.com.
You are making a difference, the deserving. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's available for you to witness very soon, a film by Ryan Busch out of Holland, a Holland-born filmmaker, produced by Claim Cinema. Here's the work, Michigan's Skiing Legacy in the Heart of Ski Season. We are, so I bring you on to talk about this wealthy theater experience and Knickerbocker theater experience on the 21st and 22nd. Ryan, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Glad that you are here, and here we see a labor of love, thanks to the work that you've been doing for some time, this heartfelt tribute to a vibrant community and more. You hail from Holland, Ryan?
I am. I've been born and raised in Holland. My family's from Grand Rapids, greater area as well, so it was a good excuse to bring it to both communities, Grand Rapids and Holland, but I went to school up in Marquette at Northern Michigan University.
You are. That's still considered our Michigan. Tell me, Ryan, are you a skier?
I am. I was born into a skiing family, yes, of course, and
nice.
Been very, very grateful of my opportunities locally here in the Midwest, but also had a few excuses to go out west and experience the big mountains as well. But ultimately, I'm back in the Great Lakes region in Michigan right now, so.
Well, thanks to Stacy from Friends of Grand Rapids Park for the hookup. We do experience your labor of love, Michigan's Skiing Legacy. Again, Wealthy Theater, Knickerbocker will give all the details. What is this work that you've been experimenting, that you've been doing for us?
So the story itself, Michigan's Skiing Legacy, the legacy part of it, really came down to Michigan has contributed a large amount of labor of love in the ski industry since 1887. The Ishpeming Ski Club, under the direction of Carl Tellefson, was the club's first president in 1887. He was a miner, and his father was a ski organizer in Norway, and he was then immigrated here to the States and went up to the Upper Peninsula for the mining industry back in the late 1800s. And so that is where the first ski club started and the first skiing competition inside the United States. And it's been going on there since 1888 was the first skiing competition in the United States. And the film also navigates a wide range of topics. The film itself is all about the Upper Peninsula and its contribution with a bunch of different legacy aspects to it. So, and I'm hoping this is a part two. I hope this is a part one of a part two series, because definitely the lower peninsula needs another film all by itself as well.
Yes, don't stop here, but yet stop and take a breath. We see you, Wealthy Theater, January 21st, and the Knickerbocker Theater on January 22nd. Whose voices do we hear from specifically, Ryan?
How do you mean?
Who are some of your interviewees, your spokespersons, your stars? Yeah.
I interview a ton of representatives within the film itself. But two people that really stand out in the film that really hit home with their talking points, they're Tom Kelly and Frida Wara. Both have been locally present in the Upper Peninsula for some time. Tom has since moved to Salt Lake City. He's been there for a number of years now. But Frida Wara, she's an amazing individual that lives and breathes in Marquette. She has a podcast, and her and Tom both do the induction ceremony for the Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame for a number of years now. But those two specifically really understand the history and the dedication that the UP really kind of holds true to. A number of other people, but those two really stand out at the back, you know, the front of my mind, who really made the film possible with their knowledge and their dedication to the history side of skiing and snowboarding within the area.
Very cool. Ryan, how can we find out information about times and how-tos for our attendance?
Yeah, more information can be found on my website, claimcinema.studio. That will just bring you to the wide range of things that I've been involved with, and you can kind of navigate through my site. And it's pretty straightforward to get to the Michigan Skiing Legacy, where you can watch the trailer. You can watch, you can kind of see what the story is about, see who's all involved. And of course, you can see future screening dates and ticket information. Some ticket information, there's some free events and some, you know, the tickets that are available up there. Still working on navigating on getting ticket sales with a couple of locations, but at least you can stay updated on that.
Much more to discuss, but yet find you on, as you mentioned, your claimcinema.com. Enjoy your Michigan audience. I'm sure there will be a standing ovation as we witness your work, Michigan's Skiing Legacy. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
Big day is Monday, MLK Day. Hopefully you celebrating in your way that fits your needs. Why not head to Muskegon Heights? My next guest here to discuss an MLK Day community celebration that does return come Monday, noon to 2. We get all the specifics. Navarro's Mexican Takeout, the place to be. 365 days a year, I'm sure. Good that you are here. You would be the business owner, Mari Sierra. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us.
And you, as part of this collaboration with Coalition for Community Development, Carrie Vanderhoff. Good morning to you, Executive Director Carrie.
Good morning, Shelley. Good to be back.
Oh, Navarro's Mexican Takeout. What am I taking out?
All the Mexican food in Muskegon Heights for almost 50 years.
Wow. Who's Navarro?
So Navarro was my grandparents. I am the third generation owner. So we started with Angel Luis and Connie Navarro back in 78 as a grocery store. And now we've transitioned to takeout only.
Nice. Carrie, are you a customer?
I am. The tamales especially.
Mm. I was hoping for an example. Next time, bring me a sample. Navarro's Mexican Takeout in collaboration with, of course, the local nonprofit Coalition for Community Development in partnership with the city of Muskegon Heights. Along with many others, too many to list. Carrie Hoffman, or Vanderhoff, remind me of the good work of CCD.
Well, CCD was founded in 2005 by Dr. Doris Rux, and we really are a grassroots organization, resident-centered. And the vision and mission is to be an organization that empowers one another, and we seek to build relationships with neighbors to support a thriving community in Muskegon Heights. Sometimes that looks like school gardens. Sometimes that looks like beautification. Sometimes it looks like big collaborations like we're doing here.
Yay, very timely. All right, Mari, I digress with Navarro's Mexican Takeout, but we'll probably talk about it again. What is happening on MLK Day?
We are so excited to be partnering with the City of Muskegon Heights and CCD to be reviving MLK Day celebration at Johnny O'Harris Park. So we are going to have free tamales, of course, from me, hot cocoa, brand new books about MLK, so celebrating our national hero, but also bringing it back locally, celebrating the life of Johnny O'Harris at Johnny O'Harris Park. He was a Muskegon Heights police officer who died in the line of duty. So we want to make sure that we're bringing the community together, having a good time, celebrating these national and local heroes, and just having fun with the babies.
Yes, it's very cool. This Johnny O'Harris Memorial Park, in general, where is it located?
The park is located on Broadway, just a little bit off of Getty. Easy to find, right in the neighborhood. And you'll see us sledding, and the smell of tamales will bring you right to us.
Yes, there you go. Officer Harris, as you mentioned, served with dignity, honor, and love. So nice to have his memory staying with us. There is, let's look at the general day from noon to 2. I'll stay with you, Mari, it's a free event with the free event, yes?
Yes, completely free. So like I said, the tamales, books, hot cocoa, but we also are going to have some winter hats. So if it is a little bit chilly, they'll be there for the kids as well. We really just wanted to have a low effort day for the community to come out and celebrate. So no work for you. We're doing all of it. Just come have fun with us.
I'll give you a plug, and Carrie, maybe back me up on this. Mari and her wonderful Navarro's Mexican Takeout sought to bring the celebration back to life?
Yeah, well, it started, I think, last year. The celebration was a tradition, and it had things like chili cook-off and whatnot, but the pandemic sort of disrupted that. And it's my understanding that it was Mari who got together with another local business, Web Chemical, to build a sled library to bring that back to the park. And then this year said, working with the city and thinking, we need to bring the whole tradition back of that MLK Day. Kids are off from school. Families often have the day off. It's a great day to get together and celebrate in a city that really loves to be with neighbors and share these things together. So she's now on the CCD board, our newly minted vice president of the board.
Yay.
And she brought this proposal to CCD and said, hey, can we organize? Can we get a little bit more people together and really bring this tradition back? So she was the catalyst to doing that, and we were very receptive to it. So
see what happens when you're crowned one of the future 15 back in your a bit ago, and leadership grows under you. Yes, we are talking about a collaboration, MLK Day Community Celebration, returning come Monday noon to 2. We'll give all the details. That's your Muskegon Heights, speaking with Mari Sierra of Navarro's Mexican Takeout and Carrie Vanderhoff, Executive Director, Coalition for Community Development. What is the little free sled library?
It is a wonderful addition to Johnny O'Harris Park. It's just a structure that holds sleds. So this park is known in our community for being the place in Muskegon Heights to sled. And we wanted to make sure whether you were there with or without a sled that you could have a good time. So grab a sled, use it at your own risk, have a great time, and then put it back. So we will have sleds there on MLK Day and throughout the season. So come enjoy on Monday with us, but if you can't make it, the sled library is there throughout the winter.
Yes, I want to come back to, again, why we should be attending, but Carrie, more work that your Coalition for Community Development does, and any other big things that will be coming up this year?
Well, I think that this is sort of we're usually really happy to collaborate. It's a core value that we have, and this year we're increasingly so. And so much so that one of the things in our board retreat is to really engage and go to the community with surveys, with focus groups, and really understand what it is the community is looking for, and then build more of these kind of collaborations. We won't give up, obviously, on our core programs like the school gardens, the nutrition, a lot of those things that are literacy, libraries, but really more collaborations and more events such as this, and having it be driven by interacting with the community.
Your CCD has been a part of the Muskegon Heights community since 2005. This much thanks to your founder, Dr. Doris Rux.
Doris Rux was a force of nature. You mention her name and you get great stories. You really do. She actually was a professor at Grand Valley, so she's been and an MCC. But really the impetus, and she's been involved in community activism and events of such. She really loved her community. But it was in 2005 that Muskegon Heights was losing its last remaining grocery store. And to her, kids need fresh food, good nutrition, and sort of gathered friends together to push that forward. And that did end up going away, but that evolved into school gardens, community gardens, the libraries. She really was a person who believed in her fellow human beings and believed in what we can accomplish together. And she moved mountains. So we're carrying on her legacy in that way.
Mari, why did you say yes to being the next generation on behalf of Navarro's Mexican Takeout? You could have done anything.
I planned on doing anything else. I grew up in the restaurant and swore I was never going to come back. I moved away from Muskegon, but my mom unfortunately passed away from leukemia in 2020, and our family was forced with the decision of what to do. And my brother and I were like, that's a wrap. The restaurant business is a lot of work. But my husband, he said, we have to try. Your mom made this happen. Even when she was sick, we have to try. So next month, we will officially have tried 5 years, which is so very exciting. And I'm just so very proud because we have received so much love from our community, and we're happy to give it back and be able to continue this legacy. The goal is to make it to 50 years. So we're almost there, just a couple years shy. So we're going to keep trying.
Very cool. So what's the secret? Oh, you might not be able to tell me. To a fantastic tamale. I'll start with you, Mari.
The secret for us is we stone grind our corn in-house. So most other tamales that you'll have, especially here in West Michigan, they're using instant corn flour. So taking a bag of flour, adding some water, and that's how they make their dough. We take the whole corn kernels, we cook it low and slow, it has to steep overnight, and then we're stone grinding it at Navarro's. So that is so much more TLC, which is already, you know, if someone gives you tamales, it's because they really love you, because they are such a laborious food to make. But we are taking it a step further in stone grinding that corn in-house. So there is a lot of love in our tamales.
What do you like about the tamale, Carrie?
Well, I can feel that love that's put into it. They're that tasty. But also just go into their restaurant and you can tell they're part of the community. You can see they have a pass it forward meal board where people can buy a meal and others can come in and choose one if they don't have the means perhaps and want a hot meal. So I think it's the love that you feel in the food because they're such, I don't know, such a long-standing part of the community.
Yeah. Winding down, again, Monday, a very big day. Tell me how you would describe Muskegon Heights and its move to the future.
For me, I was so excited to come back because there were so many wonderful things happening in the city of Muskegon Heights, and they continue to happen. I think finding the light in our community and our community members is so amazing. So like Carrie said, we know that things aren't great for a lot of people in the world right now. So finding the opportunity to be the light and to be the good wherever we can, and finding that and seeing that in our community members just makes me so excited to see what's to come for the city of Muskegon Heights.
Well, get a taste come Monday. I'll start with you on goodbyes, executive director, of course, of our partnership Coalition for Community Development, Carrie Vanderhoff. How do we find out more information, please, about you?
You can go to our website at mhccd.org. That's MuskegonHeightsCCD.org, mhccd.org, or our Facebook page or Instagram.
Good. Are you going to limit yourself to one tamale?
Nope.
Okay, good. All right, I'll let you finish us up with details one more time for Monday, please, Mari.
Yes, so Monday, please join us at Johnny O'Harris Park from noon to 12. Come hungry, come happy, come ready to sled. We're very excited to see you. If you forget those details, make sure to check out the Facebook event page, which is hosted by Navarro's Mexican Takeout on Facebook as well as CCD, or the CCD website also has more info.
Right. All right. Enjoy the celebration on Monday for many, including Johnny O'Harris and his service to Muskegon Heights and more. Carrie and Mari, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a new year, but for many Michigan families, the struggle to make ends meet remains. Let me do the introduction and then the players involved. Helping to ease our burdens, DTE Energy is donating $15 million to help provide critical energy assistance throughout several nonprofits in our area, and you bet one in the house. So I introduce you. Thank you, Jason Sparks, Director of Customer Service at DTE. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for you. Major Tim Meyer, no stranger to our airwaves, Kent County Coordinator for the Salvation Army. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Shelley.
I know, coming off a holiday roll where that time of year always important, but yet here we are in January continuing to discuss how the community can help. Remind me of the good work of the Salvation Army.
Well, as we've mentioned before, while we're more visible at Christmas time, we are serving the community year-round. All of Michigan, in fact, is served by the Salvation Army. And so we're here today to talk about this generous donation from DTE. They're entrusting some of it to the Salvation Army and how that's going to benefit Michigan residents.
Yes, and of course, our Salvation Army Great Lakes Division under your leadership. Thank you. How would you best describe the work, Jason, of DTE Energy in general?
So at DTE, we're committed to strengthening our communities by ensuring that families have the support they need to stay safe and warm this winter. And really, our priority is providing meaningful support for our customers year-round, but especially during the coldest months of the year like we're in right now, which is a time when many vulnerable families need a little bit of extra help. So to alleviate this strain, as previously mentioned, we have provided a $15 million donation to three different community organizations, split $5 million each to the Heat and Warmth Fund out of Detroit, United Way for Southeastern Michigan, and then also the Salvation Army Great Lakes Division. And I think what's great about this donation that we provided is this will actually support about 10,000 vulnerable families to help keep them safe and warm this winter by preventing service disruptions, as well as lowering and eliminating past due balances. And really, we have a wide variety of energy assistance programs that we offer at DTE in partnership with many community agencies like the Salvation Army. And eligibility for these donation funds that were recently provided starts at about $70,000 a year for a family of four and below. So we really encourage anyone that's experiencing any kind of difficulty with their energy bill to reach out as soon as possible. There's a lot of pathways and there's a lot of tools and a lot of programs that are available. And the sooner that you connect with us here at DTE or through Salvation Army, the better that we are able to assist you work through some of those needs.
Great. Again, those recipients, including Thaw and UWSCM, but let's put the spotlight on the Salvation Army Great Lakes Division. Why this as one of your choices? And of course, Major Tim is listening.
Yes. So we have a longstanding partnership with the Salvation Army that goes back at least 20 years. And they have been a great partner in helping support the communities. And really, they live the same values that we live by here at DT and in supporting our vulnerable customers and making sure that families in need get the support that they need to help stay safe in the winter.
So, Major Tim Meyer, what was that phone call, that email, that, I guess, text like to receive?
It's such a blessing. We have what is called our EAS program, Energy Assistance Services, and we serve some in fiscal year 25, some 12,240 households statewide. And that was an increase of about 3.8%. Year to date, we've already had this year some 1,500 households who have benefited from this program. The reason this is such a blessing is that we typically run out of funds in midsummer. Mm-hmm. And folks are still getting utility bills from the winter and catching up with things. And so we have information, this will enable us to continue serving much longer and for some people at a very crucial time. And so we're very appreciative of DTE and their generosity in considering the Salvation Army to be one of the agencies that is disseminating these funds.
Even more in particular, Major Tim, again, we often think of our Salvation Army that you're only there for the disasters, but your year-round work includes more than that.
Yeah, we had a call from a gentleman who was living in a tent, and he had found a place that he could rent a room for $850. Well, that doesn't sound bad, but his total disability is $905 a month, and so he's trying to stretch everything, and so something like this is something that will help him to manage funds better, to have some help with energy assistance. We also provide, of course, food assistance with groceries. We have senior assistance. We do disaster work, as you've referenced. But this is an ongoing program. And again, it benefits every zip code in Michigan. So we're so appreciative of this. And this is part of just one of the things that Salvation Army does year-round.
Yes. Jason, back to you and your customer service. As you mentioned, help is available I trust even now as we speak in this mid-January, the sooner customers reach out, the sooner assistance can begin. Is calling 211 appropriate here?
Yes. Yep. So there's several avenues that customers can reach out if they need assistance. One is to call 211 and seek assistance that way. You can also contact DT Energy directly, and we can route you for assistance as well there. All of our assistance programs are on our website at dtenergy.com/help. Or you can call our 1-800 number, which is 1-800-477-4747. And just wanted to reiterate once again to please reach out as soon as you can. There are more benefits and more tools and more ways that we in the Salvation Army can help our customers out. The sooner they reach out, the better.
Yes, do not wait, because it's cold out, as you say. Winding down, Major Tim Meyer on behalf of Kent County, you coordinator for our Salvation Army. A couple more points, please.
Yeah, just so the listeners are aware, this helps people through a crisis time, but there's much more involved with our EAS workers there. So they work with case management, they help with budgeting, they help people understand that there could be a budget program or other additional assistance they can receive through energy companies. And so it's not just, call in and here's the money. There's an effort to help inform, and many energy companies will have programs that will help people be more efficient with heating and cooling and stopping losses that way. And if folks want to contact the Salvation Army, of course, they can go to sagreatlakes.org. If you're here in Kent County, it might be more convenient to go to sakentcounty.org, and there they can find out about this program as well as the myriad of things the Salvation Army does in Kent County. So we have a Croc Center, as you're aware of, that we do swim lessons for third graders the school district. We do so many things for senior citizens, and we have seniors program at Fulton Heights, just any number of things that go on, as well as our food pantry and other case services at Fuller and Fulton.
All takes funds to run, however, and more. Major Tim Meyer, thank you very much. Your final word and review, please, Jason Sparks, on behalf of DTE Energy.
Yeah, I just really want to thank you for the time and for this opportunity to get the message out to our customers in need. It's avenues like this that allow us to distribute these funds and partnerships like Salvation Army. So also wanted to say thank you to Salvation Army for your continued partnership, and thank you for serving our communities.
On behalf of Major Tim Meyer, you are welcome. All right, congratulations to Salvation Army and, of course, to Thaw, WSEM, and, of course, the many recipients. DT Energy donating $15 million to help provide critical energy assistance. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Shelley.